However, you do not have to take my word for this. I'd like to cite the thoughts of Murray Hunt, a leading academic in this field and more recently an advisor to the committee itself. He insists that, and I quote, Parliament's role in relation to human rights has increased, not decreased, since the passage of the Human Rights Act. The number of substantive debates on human rights issues has increased. Most significant human rights issues of the day are now likely to be recognised as such and debated in some form or other in Parliament. The human rights literacy of parliamentarians has also increased. A wider range of members in both houses raise human rights issues, including a growing number of members who are not lawyers. Human rights instruments other than the ECHR, such as the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child or the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, are more frequently referred to in parliamentary debate. Overall, informed debate about human rights appears to take place more often. I cite these words not simply to offer a round of applause to Parliament. I do so because what I have outlined surely enriches our democracy and serves, in my view, to strengthen our society. Those who most often need their rights respected are not always comfortably located inside so-called Middle Britain, but those who have reason to sense that they are outsiders. The Joint Committee on Human Rights constituency is frequently the marginalised, the misunderstood, and the maligned. Parliament has to represent these people too. There ends the sermon. I hope I have convinced you both of my own commitment to human rights and that Parliament as an institution is aligned with these issues as never before. In conclusion, as suggested earlier, I am an optimist about these matters. My hope is spurred by three considerations. The first is that, whether at home or abroad, it is thankfully becoming ever harder to engage in human wrongs without witnesses. The nature of modern communications makes abuse much harder to hide. Whether it be bureaucratic insensitivity to the vulnerable here in the British Isles or outrageous abuse elsewhere, we are becoming ever more aware of what is occurring. Transparency is our ally in this respect. The searchlight is our beacon to a better Britain and over time to a less imperfect world. The second is my certainty that the vast change we have seen in Parliament is a process and not an event. It will continue. I am struck from my, I think you would agree, fairly advantageous vantage point by the force with which so many MPs from right across the spectrum use the many opportunities that parliamentary instruments provide to raise constituency cases, which are important individual stories, obviously, but which also form part of a broader human rights narrative. This is unquestionably far more true today than when I was first elected to the House of Commons 16 years ago. The House of Commons will not retreat to a dark age in which few were interested in these matters. Human rights are here to stay at the very heart of our work, in the chamber, in committees, and in conversations with our constituents. Finally, I am inspired by the instincts of younger people whom I encounter on all my visits. For them, matters of human rights and human wrongs are not distant concerns which come far behind traditional economic imperatives or mainstream public services questions. Rather, these matters are integral to their belief systems. No politician or political party is likely to travel far in the politics of the future by professing indifference to equality and the decent treatment of all those who live in our country. I have absolute faith that while the trip may take longer than many of us might like, we are on a one-way ticket towards a culture of mutual respect and tolerance of almost everything except intolerance. The further we traverse on that path, the more meaningful our democracy will be to ever greater numbers of people. One person, one vote is a noble cause. One person, one vote, one value is even more desirable. There can be few better places than Belfast, and few more appropriate times than Pride Week to issue such a declaration. In the end, I do not accept the dictum that politics is just the art of the possible, but instead I maintain that it is the art of what we choose to make possible. This week is a tribute to what has been made possible in a relatively short period of time, from criminalisation of a type of love fewer than 50 years ago to the imminent prospect of complete legal equality. Let us all resolve to leave here determined that there is more that we can and will make possible in the years ahead. For your attendance, your interest, and your patience, thank you very much indeed.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. We will call you Mr. Speaker in deference to your high office, but we're also going to call you John because you're clearly amongst friends here. And that was terrific. Thank you very much, John. Where did this begin for you as a journey? I mean, this journey that's brought you to this point, to having a coat of arms, which includes the pink triangle and freedom symbolism. Is there a personal moment in your life where that began?
There is, William, and thank you for focusing on the personal, because it's so often the motivation for the actions that we take. We don't necessarily dilate on the personal all that often, but it's relevant. Ladies and gentlemen, to my considerable embarrassment and discredit, I voted at least once, if not, I think, twice, in my very early years in Parliament, against proposals to equalise the age of consent. If I'm candid with you, I hadn't given a lot of thought to the subject in previous years, and in common with most of my Conservative colleagues, and I was a Conservative Member of Parliament for 12 years before I became Speaker, I instinctively resisted, I won't say recoiled from, but resisted change, and went along rather lazily, not in a very shrill fashion, with the view that said, "'Tis not necessary, let's keep it as it is, all a bit bold and radical to change it." And I think the second time round, William, I thought afterwards about it, and I felt uncomfortable with what I'd done because I didn't really think that I could rationally defend it to myself. And I asked myself the question, is the statutory differential, the statutory discrimination, the statutory apartheid, if you will, between straight people and LGBT people necessary? And you can tell by the very fact that I was asking the question that I was sceptical. And so I spoke to a couple of head teachers in secondary schools in my Buckingham constituency and to a couple of local church leaders, none of whom was able or inclined to offer a very strong view in favour of preserving the differential. And so I thought about it, and I thought, no, it just doesn't hang together. So I arranged to meet Stonewall, which was by then becoming established as an ever more vociferous and potentially effective organisation. I met the then chief executive, Angela Mason, and I just felt, no, it's not necessary. So what happened, actually, was that The government came forward with the Sexual Offences Amendment Bill in the beginning of 2000, and I bumped in a few days before to a colleague of mine called Tim Boswell, who now sits in the House of Lords, who's a patrician, very liberal-minded, progressive Tory, who'd long, I think, voted for an equal age of consent at 16. And he said to me, John, I know you've been thinking about it. Are you going to vote for equality? And I said, I'm minded to, Tim. And he said, do you mind if I offer you a word of advice? And I said, no, please do. And he said, if you're going to vote for an equal age of consent when you've previously voted the other way, it's a good idea to speak in the debate. Tell the House, and indirectly, therefore, your constituents, why you've changed your mind. And
I said, I think I will.
My coming out moment. So I said, I think I will.
Yeah.
And I said, I am minded to do so. The only slight problem I've got, I'm not going to be put off from doing it, the only slight problem I've got, Tim, is that Sir Desmond Fennell, former chairman of the Bar Council, very prominent and active and vociferous constituent of mine, is fanatically opposed. And I know that he'll go potty if I vote in this way. To which Tim, rather a gentleman, responded strikingly, stuff Sir Desmond Fennell. He said, no, John, the answer is very simple. You speak in the debate and you simply send to Sir Desmond subsequently a copy of your speech explaining why you took the view you didn't. So anyway, the long and short of it is that's what I did, and it was, I think, the 10th of February 2000. And, of course, you then make the linkages. My wife always says to me, you're quite slow to arrive at the right conclusion, but once you really get it, you know, you've got it. And at the time, absurd though it seems, I was persuaded of the argument for the equal age of consent, but not of the case for repeal of Section 28. And then I started to think through the linkages, obviously, and you see that similar arguments apply. So it went from age of consent to thinking there's a very good case for getting rid of a really pernicious piece of legislation, Section 28, and for supporting the right of gay and unmarried couples more widely jointly to adopt children, and so on and so forth. I actually resigned from the Ian Duncan Smith Shadow Cabinet over the issue of unmarried couples having the right jointly to adopt children. So I think that's some indication to you that I felt very strongly that that right should be supported. And it really went from there. So equal age of consent, getting rid of Section 28, equal adoption rights, civil partnership, which was the cause at the time. And I've never looked back. I obviously don't vote these days on political issues in Parliament because the British Speaker doesn't unless there's a tie. There's not been a tie in the House of Commons since 1994. So I don't vote. If constituents write to me and ask me what I think about equal marriage, then I must admit I'm explicit with them. I explain that as Speaker I won't vote because I can't, but I don't duck it. And I must admit I've had a good many letters against because people tend to write when they're against things. And I set out all of the arguments in favour of equal marriage, and then I tend to conclude by saying I appreciate that this will be a disappointing reply as far as you're concerned. However, given that politicians are frequently accused of sitting on the fence, ducking the question, insisting on talking about something other than that which is of interest to their interrogator, you will presumably accept that my reply is both clear and honest. We must agree honourably to differ. Thank you and goodbye.
We're going to come to you as well. We'll have a couple of microphones. We'll move around at the room. You mentioned 50 years since decriminalisation, 30 years since decriminalisation here, of course, which tells you something. That 20 years difference is mapped across many issues of gay rights, human rights for gay people in Northern Ireland, civil partnerships here, until recently. Gay couples couldn't adopt. They still can't have civil partnerships in churches. Same-sex marriage may come into the Republic, into England, Scotland, Wales, not here unless probably there's legal action in the courts. From the vantage point of where you are in England, how does this journey towards human rights for gay people in Northern Ireland look? How does it appear?
The journey has been in the right direction. It has, of course, simply as a matter of fact, been sharply slower than what we have enjoyed, and I emphasise enjoyed, elsewhere in the United Kingdom. Look, devolution is a constitutional fact. I accept that, And, of course, you know, in the pursuit of my day-to-day duties, I try to get on with all of my parliamentary colleagues. I said Naomi is a superb parliamentarian, which she assuredly is. There are very good parliamentarians in all of the political parties, and I hope that I will always treat all members with courtesy and consideration, and I respect their right to hold their point of view. I think that the battle in Northern Ireland will overwhelmingly be fought in Northern Ireland, and I don't think it's for me or another member of Parliament from England, Scotland or Wales to second-guess the Assembly, the Executive or your courts, but am I hopeful that Northern Ireland will come to enjoy just the same equality as we elsewhere enjoy? Of course I'm hopeful. This seems to me to be an absolutely natural and laudable human aspiration. And I think that the encouraging thing elsewhere in the UK, I hope it proves in due course to be true in Northern Ireland, is that increasingly the support for equality is strong across the political spectrum. I personally think it is very much to the credit of the British Prime Minister that he has pursued the same-sex couples marriage bill. There are a lot of people in his party who are strenuously opposed, but he believes it to be the right thing to do. And what I always feel, I don't wish this to sound flippant, is that in a period of 10 years' time, perhaps even less, I just have this sense that people will think, about what was all this fuss? Ladies and gentlemen, I got a couple of hundred letters about this matter. I got one letter from someone who, when I answered him, wrote back. And that's, I say that because that's relatively unusual. Somebody will write to you, you explain to them their view, and that's usually the end of it. But anyway, he perfectly properly wrote back and said he appreciated my thoughtful and detailed reply, but he didn't agree with me. And his point, I don't know whether you get this in Northern Ireland, was as follows. John, I've been married to my wife for 38 years. If this bill becomes law, where do we go? And I said to him, but Christopher, my dear fellow, you don't have to go anywhere. I mean, good luck to you. You've been married for 38 years and you cherish your marriage and so on, but surely the health and vitality, sustenance of your marriage do not depend upon stopping other people having the right to get married. I think it's that sense that some people want to have, that somehow their arrangement is not just different but superior. And if you ask me, do I think that my marriage, a heterosexual marriage, is somehow superior to a gay or lesbian marriage, the answer is no, I don't. And I don't need it to be regarded as superior. So you are considerably behind us. I hope that you will achieve full equality. And I believe in the indomitable power of the human spirit and the sheer justice of the cause of equality. And if it has won through in the rest of the kingdom, it will prevail in Northern Ireland.
Comments? Who's up first? Just put your hand up right down here, and then I'll come to you as well. Yeah, put your hand up at any point, and we can come to you. Go right ahead. Thanks.
Hi there. A number of days ago, a DUP MLA sat on this very stage and explained to the audience how there are two types of equality, and that the LGBT community are not entitled, in his opinion, to absolute equality. And it is for that reason that the LGBT community have achieved much of what they have through our courts in Northern Ireland and not the Assembly, as it's unfortunately a majority opinion seems to be similar to that DUP members. My concern is our courts in Northern Ireland, the courts, the Supreme Court and right the whole way up to the European Court of Human Rights, are extremely important for this community. And I'm concerned that party politics, largely in the mainland UK, are threatening the UK's membership of the European Court of Human Rights and everything that the jurisprudence of that court has done for equality generally. And I wondered if you shared similar concerns that party politics are threatening the UK's membership.
First of all, can I say in relation to the MLA, I had heard this point made before I came here this evening, although I'm befuddled, flummoxed, perplexed as to what these two types of equality are. I mean, I don't suppose you particularly have the appetite or inclination to expatiate on this point, and you may well feel that it isn't something that you could easily do, as it's his rather curious notion.
Well, maybe it's gay equality and straight equality. Something as simple as that.
Yes.
I asked him a question, and I said, who are you to chat? Because I asked a question too, and it was me who asked him. And I said to him...
Do you want to grab that microphone there?
I said to him, who are you? It doesn't work, William.
Hold it close to your mouth. Well, you did ask. Go ahead, Dave.
So I was the one that asked him the question, and I said, I want you to tell me, as a lesbian woman, who are you to tell me who to love? That was a question I asked him, and he looked at me and he went, you have two different types of equality.
And again, yes, I mean, I just think, to be blunt about it, it's nonsense. Nonsense on stilts. I mean, I remember in the early years arguing...
We're off and running now, aren't
we?
I
remember in the early years when I was making some of these arguments about LGBT equality that the noble Lord Tebbit of Chingford, whom I've known for 25 years and more, saying to me, I'm bound to say, John, that I am somewhat disappointed in the course you've taken on these matters. And he was in particular keen to make the argument to me that we do have equal rights, but equal rights to do different things.
Yes.
And I thought that his line of argument was curious, and I said to him, well, on the assumption, Norman, that people who are gay or lesbian cannot be expected and should not be encouraged, effectively, dishonestly, as so often sadly used to happen, to marry people of the opposite sex, I am arguing that they should have a right, at that time the argument was about civil partnership, formally to enshrine their relationship with legal recognition. And so I just don't see your point about equal rights to do different things. People want to make a commitment to each other of a formal character enshrined in law with all the concomitant rights and obligations that that entails. And my view is that that has to be the same right whether people are heterosexual or gay. Now, as you know, for a variety of reasons, probably reasons of practicality or political calculation, the initial step was to civil partnership rather than marriage. And if people say, well, what's changed? You know, why should it now be converted into marriage? I say, well, because I think that society's attitudes have actually moved on. I do find it a bit bizarre when I encounter people who say, oh, I don't know why there's this argument about the importance of equal marriage. The gays have got civil partnerships and should be perfectly happy with that. And I'm quite happy with that, Mr. Burke. And I look back and I see from the correspondence that at the time they were absolutely, fundamentally, irreconcilably opposed to civil partnership and thought that it would herald the demise of Western civilization as we know it. So, you know, I think there are some rather curious people who are suddenly arguing that, you know, civil partnership is fine. No, society's attitudes have moved on. Look, on this question of whether I'm concerned about the court, the whole question of the future protection of human rights is a matter of political dispute. And as you know, the government, or the Conservative part of the Conservative Lib Dem coalition government, has talked about the possibility of changing the nature of the UK's commitment to human rights. And I suspect that will remain a live argument. I believe passionately in human rights. I admit, and if I didn't, you could soon discover, that at the time, in 1998, just as I was wrong about all sorts of other things, I was wrong about the Human Rights Act. I voted against it, in fact, to my very considerable embarrassment. It can't be expunged from the parliamentary record. It's there for all to see. I spoke against the bill. I long ago came to the view that the Human Rights Act had huge advantages, and incorporation of the convention in British law on the whole made great sense. I would point out, by the way, that the European Convention was something championed not by some extreme leftist, but by Winston Churchill as a Conservative Prime Minister in the aftermath of the Second World War. So I think that it has much to be said for it. And if you are asking me, have I in recent times ever argued for or given support to people arguing for departure from the European Convention or the repeal of the Human Rights Act? I most certainly have not. I think it is very, very, very important, whatever view about particular pieces of legislation people take in the United Kingdom, that we do and say nothing which has the effect of undermining British respect for, commitment to, and implementation of what people would regard as human rights obligations. While a thing is the subject of competitive dispute, there is always an element of risk. But as I say, I don't think that anything should be done that would cause people to think, the country's not so committed to human rights anymore. If anything, we need to do more. We need to ratchet up our commitment.
Since you mentioned Norman Tebbit, what did you think of Norman Tebbit's concern that we might have a lesbian queen one day who could produce an heir through in vitro fertilisation? Is that a pressing issue at the Palace of Westminster?
Well, it's a pressing issue in the mind of the noble lord. But I can't be accountable, William, for what preoccupies the noble lord.
You're a lawyer, not a psychiatrist.
I can't understand what's going on there. I don't know why he thinks as he does.
Well,
I mean,
dodged.
Norman is a superb propagandist. He is well able graphically to illustrate his point of view, and he has the ability and sometimes the inclination both to inspire and divide. He is entitled, of course, to entertain his spectres. I respect him as a man of principle and commitment. Genuinely, I do. I respect him as a man of principle and commitment. What I would say, and I would say it if he were sitting here next to me now, is that I defend Norman's right to hold the views on LGBT matters that he does. I simply make the point that he suffers from the material disadvantage of being wrong.
All right, over there. Very good. Gentleman on the left, then we'll move across. Get to you in a second. Yeah.